I had to cut a few questions and answers from that presentation for the sake of time, but one of them was about strategies. How in the modern age can we focus more and be less distracted by what's going on? How can we be more creative? How can we engage our highest human faculties? And Nicholas Carr's answer echoed my own experience. For several months earlier this year, I had no internet connection, and after a short period, I must say, I didn't actually miss it. I won't be able to do that again, or I'll fail to produce this radio show, but at the time, it certainly helped me to concentrate, so that's recommended if you feel like giving it a go. Our main presentation is by a speaker called Heather Menzies, who wrote a book called No Time, Stress, and the Crisis of Modern Life, which brings together a range of topics, but certainly links to the Murray Bookchin from 512, which stressed the importance of quality as well as just quantity, the latter, of course, being what is easily recorded on computers, what can be used for targets, and what can be used to create performance indicators, data streams. And so she has a couple of anecdotes which highlight the importance of personal reflective thought on one's surroundings and on one's values. This is, in some senses, an opposite to how the machine behaves. It's impersonal. It is anything but reflective. It is automated. As Murray Bookchin pointed out, our conception of nature and the natural order of things is a reflection of our social order. And so the rise of machines in the Industrial Revolution created another metaphor with which to view society. If you're a regular listener to this show, I suspect that the idea of society running as a well-oiled machine may hold less than great appeal for you. Heather Menzies is guarded in what she says, but towards the end of her talk, she hints that people are being prepared for a totalitarian government. Now, for a sense of perspective, and to lead you into her talk, I thought I would play a few minutes of the late great thinker Ivan Illich speaking. This is from an hours-long CBC program about the history of seeing, a subject, like many of Illich's topics, which is quite puzzling initially. And he's talking about how people's conception of images changed. So, to a certain extent, it's preparation not only for maps, but the life of screen watching, which is familiar, I dare say, to too many of you.
Leonardo da Vinci, around 1502, 1503, says, when he dissects the bodies of hanged men whom he purchased from the executioner, to his pupils, you must draw everything you see in a human body, because in the flesh the eye can't see anything. Only when you have drawn it and drawn it again and again will you slowly understand what you're speaking about. From that almost foreshadowing of the ideas of the 17th century, in the late 15th and early 16th, we move pretty quickly to the idea that the best way, still staying in the example of anatomy, of writing about the body, is to have a draftsman draft it as he sees it according to the rules of monocular fixed standpoint, perspectival representation, and then have your text discussing about the feature in the image marked with an A, a B, or a C. Modern science began, basically, with the interpretation of designs. In many areas of Europe, you couldn't get the degree at the university, much less become a state employee, if you didn't pass an exam in drawing, because reports home, reports to your chief, reports to the king, had to be illustrated to be credible. But this was always an illustration which still placed the designer into the picture, even if invisibly, through the rules of perspective. Then in the 19th century, we have a completely new way of imagining the image. The image should represent what really is out there, not what the anatomists or the geographers, draftsman, sees. In scientific treatises, the demand for perspectival representation, perspectival objectivity, is abandoned, and objects are represented as measured, as mapped, as seen in an architectural drawing in which the gaze is assumed always to be perpendicular to the object represented. But draftsman creates a virtual space into which he places things as they are and not as they are seen by him. And the reader is asked to look at an object, cut through a brain, a baby, a muscle, in a space into which he never could reach.
What Illich means by a virtual space might become clearer if you think, for example, of the anatomical drawings that still appear in most biology textbooks. You begin with an image of the skeletal and muscular structure of the body, and then impose a series of transparencies, which add the organs, the nervous system, the circulatory system, and so forth. The result is not something you could ever see, nor is it pictured as existing in a space you could ever inhabit. The bloody mess that Leonardo actually saw when he peered into the bellies of his cadavers has been clarified, sorted into systems, and transposed into the idealized context in which modern persons are taught to recognize their bodies. And this is only the beginning of what Illich means by virtual or non-local space. Today, such spaces are everywhere. The Internet is a vast, simultaneous nowhere in which no one actually knows where anything is. Computer-generated images shred the distinction between the imaginary and the real. Expectant parents bond with ultrasound scans of their unborn children. We now habitually see and experience things, Illich says, in spaces that are beyond any threshold we could ever pass.
What impresses me so much is the speed with which, during the second part of my life of 70 years, virtual spaces, images, and other objects presented in virtual spaces have become generalized. There are quite a few serious thinkers now who claim that among the most important, profound changes of the last 25 years is the ubiquity of virtual spaces, in which, from which, we are asked to derive our knowledge. Today's virtual space has characteristics in which one couldn't reach, or smell, or step, or touch, in which most of the things which we take for granted are shown to us, and those which we know are better explained to us, with the idea that only if you have seen it on television, it's believable in reality.
That was a few minutes from an hour-long series by CBC. I hope it set you in the right frame of mind for our second and final presentation this hour. a speech by Heather Menzies to an audience in Vancouver in 2005.
When computers first landed on people's office desks, I thought, there's something more than just a toy, just a new gadget happening here. I felt the ground is shifting under our feet, and I had no idea what was happening. I just knew I needed to pay attention. And of course, what's happened is that not only is the ground under our feet become wired, the walls have been wired, the ceiling's wired, we're all wired into this new zone of disembodied click, 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 click flows. Everything, standardized bits moving around hither and yon, and it's hooking us in, we're hooked in, where we begin and all that ends, and where we end and all that takes over, it's hard to tell. How to get a feel for this? How to begin to communicate it? Well, I had this sort of crazy idea that I could get a feel for this if I could connect with a trucker who hauls those look-alike container units offloaded off ships in the Vancouver Harbor, plunked onto railway cars, hitched behind truck cabs and hauled all over the place. That's the new economy. We were on the NAFTA Superhighway 401. We headed out in Toronto with a load of a mixed bag at about 5 p.m., headed down towards Montreal, got to Montreal about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, offloaded, picked up something else. Do you know what the container we brought back was full of? Styrofoam trays. Now, this guy was delighted, Wayne his name is, because it meant that his numbers were going to work out really well for him in terms of, you know, how much go he was going to get for his gas mileage, because it was like carrying feathers. The whole thing, by the time it was 10:30 at night and the highway was basically ours, all the cars had cleared off, it was just container truck fleet after container truck fleet going both ways, Montreal to Toronto, Toronto to Montreal. Everything, it was very clear what I was seeing. Everything designed for friction-free interconnectivity. You look out and you could see the suburban shopping malls with their identical cookie-cutter loading bays. Everything like a Lego set could fit together. The logos on stores, similarly brands that could, where the name could go onto just about anything in a kind of a mix-and-match way. And what I was able to see is that the connection was happening between the data on the screen, deliverables, and the realities going out there. Parts to be delivered to a factory just in time. Fast fashion to be delivered to some store because it had just been a hit on some runway. And in the darkness, you could see it very clearly because all you could see was what was lit up. And all that was lit up, all you could see were this Lego-like set of standardized interconnectable units. And it goes from the specifics of the things that I've just mentioned, like parts, standardized parts, to what's on the screen more is standardized skill sets for putting together various things, standardized procedures, standardized performance measurements, and standardized compensation packages, so that people as well as parts can be interchanged. All of it flowing and clicking together at a globally competitive pace, a pace that bullies truckers on the road and bullies people in call centers everywhere. It's all constructed, it's all simulated, it's all based on abstractions, images, ideas, buzzwords, brand names, all conjured for instant construction, instant consumption, and instant perception management. The faster the images and data flow through all the BlackBerries, the cell phones, the emails, the computers, the faster things are driven on the ground. And that's the essence of globalization as ideology, in other words, globalism. The pace is set by what can be made to happen online, transactions through financial information systems, contracting things out, outsourcing things through management information systems. And what's it like on the ground? Well, I found out sitting beside Wayne Bates going down 401. Make that delivery window, he tells me, as we drive through the night. And that's what he focuses on. And that's what counts in the new economy. Meet the deadlines set in that realm of online communication and decision making. Match or exceed the efficiency standards set, the performance benchmarks, or if possible, outperform them if you want to get more contracts. Keep your eyes on what's lit up on the screen, and everything else is lost in the darkness. All realities other than that, including the stress that these truckers are under, like the rest of us. Stress to the point of heart attacks, marriage breakdown, estrangement from their kids. Because, you see, it's all in the dark. None of it computes, so it doesn't matter. It doesn't count. It doesn't enter into the picture, not of the new economy and what counts on the screen. So I began to understand why everybody was telling me I have no time. It's not just that people are overextended. It is, as Thomas read from the beginning, it's what they're extended into. This new online medium that it's everywhere. In our cell phone in our pocket, BlackBerry here, in the computer at the kitchen, in the kitchen at home or in our bedrooms. It's everywhere. And as we are immersed more and more for more and more of the activities, not just of the economy, but for daily life, so our attention is constantly scattered and fragmented, and we are immersed in a plane of reality where we not only leave our bodies behind, but it's completely divorced from reality of the here and now. It's disembedded from that reality, it's abstracted, it's standardized so that it can be reduced to codable essentials as text messages or as data sets or whatever. It all becomes these instant symbols on the screen that can be combined and recombined, can morph and can certainly move at the speed of light. Moves at the speed of light because the medium itself is light-based. It's merely pulses. Electronic pulses. It's certainly easy to get things done when everything is stripped down to those little bits and everything is rendered, reality is rendered in lightning fast, lightning simplified terms, but at a price. The price of disconnect. So that, for instance, we're paradoxically present all kinds of places and yet not present really anywhere. We're absent. In a fundamental way, we're both present and absent. We're connected and disconnected at the same time. I think that's one of the reasons it's so easy to get hooked on multitasking, because everything is so simplified and so superficial. Consider it. When it's on the screen, there's nothing to engage the ear. There's no pauses. There's no stutter. There's no stumbling voice. It's all just there. Usually pretty functional, although you can have a smiley icon or whatever. There's nothing to engage the inclination to touch or be touched. No opportunity for empathy. So there's so little opportunity for the senses to engage. And if they were to engage, it would slow us down, of course, wouldn't it? Because we'd be catching that little hesitation. We'd be drawn in. So we'd stay. We'd be hooked in. But if there's nothing to engage the senses, except the eye blinking and it's gone, then we are left at this necessarily superficial level of engagement, which makes it so much easier to then just go on to the next thing, because it's all so superficial, it's all so ephemeral. It's almost as immaterial as the medium itself, which is, of course, immaterial. The trouble is, though, that as things on at work, for instance, or at home trashing emails, as that becomes just flash click onto the next thing, so we start to have those multitasking habits bleed over into other parts of our lives. And so we have situations, and I talked to a guy who confessed that he was a workaholic. And when he's at home, he can't stop. He can't slow down enough to listen to his kid, Jan. He said, the trouble is he talks so slowly. He's just talking like a regular person. And usually kids talk pretty fast. But it's not coming at me fast enough, this guy Rob told me. And so he said that I forget what he was. And I said, well, wait a moment. Are you breaking eye contact? I try not to be too accusatory. He said, oh, yeah, I do it all the time. He said, I know my, this is an acronym, neuro-linguistic, whatever the code word for, fancy word for body language is, that he's not really kind of engaged, you know, he's not communicating to his kid that he's engaged. Well, of course, he's not. But the trouble is that this same kind of multitasking, present but not present, paying attention for a moment but over here for the other moment, is also beginning, is affecting how people do work in places that where paying attention really counts, like hospitals and schools. Now consider what multitasking really involves. I'm sure you've caught yourself at this. I'm a little bit over here, and I'm a little bit present over there. And I'm not fully present anywhere. Present and accountable is what I mean. Answerable for your participation, where that might be. It leaves you in a strange position where you kind of have to sort of assume that somebody else is going to be fully accountable, taking responsibility for the larger picture. You hope so. Meanwhile, what I'm found happening in my research is that, in fact, of course, that isn't happening. Before I get to that, I want to just intersect one thing that I learned about stress. Now, I mean, the numbers that are out there on stress are just absolutely staggering. Nearly 50% of Canadians are overwhelmed by stress, either often or most of the time. Now, stress is not just some common, you know, little simple thing like having a hangnail. When you're severely stressed, which is what's happening, overwhelmed by stress means severely stressed, you're having chronic headaches, you're suffering from insomnia and sleep loss generally, you're having short-term memory problems, problems concentrating, and usually you start drifting into a state of depression. That's pretty big stuff here. And yet, what amazed me was people keep going and going and going. Now, you've got the particularly young people who are in short-term contracts or people in split shifts. People are locked into working in this what we have now, a crisis of overwork, just to make ends meet. And are bullied by the pace of this new economy to work harder, faster, to take the call at 11 o'clock at night and get online because somebody wants an 11th-hour revision to the report you thought you'd signed off on several hours ago. What happens with stress is that the body starts to shut down. Hans Selye, one of the leading world experts on stress and a Canadian, used the word anesthetization. And I have found myself using it to good effect, too, because it means that we are becoming unconscious, inwardly unconscious. And it's sort of like sleepwalking. We're still awake, but we have lost touch with our bodies. We're not able to fully experience our own experience. We're not feeling. We're losing a feeling for ourselves, which also means we're losing a feeling for other people. And it happens at two levels. One, you've got the direct numbing effect of cortisol, which is the bad stress hormone. And then the other thing is that when you have sleep loss, you're losing dreaming time. And when I got into the research on dreaming, it was really neat. One of the phrases that has stayed with me is that when we're dreaming, there is a kind of a sleeping brain dialogue that goes on between the cortex and the hippocampus, in which our recent experiences are being kind of processed and composted, if you're a gardener, you'll understand that, and integrated with our deep past and our deep memory associations. So the upshot is we wake up not only fresh, but whole again, able to know who we are and to focus on what is real and important. Yet in the absence of that, it helps to explain why people are easily distracted and can't pay attention, can't keep their attention focused, and have troubles concentrating. There's a second level in which anisnetization happens, and I think that this is where it begins. We start to see the effects that go beyond just stressed individuals to deeply stressed institutions and society as a whole. And that's because the desensitization, the anisnetization, is built into the medium. I already talked about how there's nothing for the senses to engage in. Well, as we spend more and more time online, where all of it is just data flowing past, it becomes just data flowing through us without touching us. Yet this is often data to do with people's health in hospital, how kids are doing in schools, how people in need of social assistance, what their realities are like. What I found when I talked to nurses in hospitals is that with the chronic short staffing that we've had since the beginning of the big cutbacks in the 1980s, not only nurses, doctors too, they're all harried. And as one nurse put it to me, it's all tasks, tasks, tasks. She said, healthcare is not supposed to be like that. Healthcare and healing is all about listening. Listening with your heart as well as with your ear, as one put it. But they don't have time for that. They have little time to actively engage in the people in their care. And when they have little time, they focus on that list of tasks on the computer screen and the diagnostic little machines, if there is any of them, that they then read and record, because that's part of the record-keeping requirement. Recording how somebody feels, whether somebody in having a conversation, because if you have a decent conversation with somebody in the hospital, you know, like a nurse, etc., and I'm sure we've all had this experience, they get to learn if there's a little bit of a cognitive problem. And that can alert them to pay more attention to making sure the person understands the need to stick on the medication if they want to make a full recovery, or to make sure that they do the therapy that is being prescribed. If they don't get that, very often then what you get is people discharged, and you get good hospital bed turnover rates that look great on the computer screen. Nevertheless, you get more and more people having to be rehospitalized. But that doesn't count, you see. That's not part of the data set. What I also found is that attention is actually shifting. This is a section that I called attention deficit culture. When I focused on nurses, what I was able to sort of almost chronicle is how nurses, with the restructuring of healthcare and particularly the nursing function into prescribed tasks, their attention is being literally shifted from the patient and the relationship, the dialogue with the patient, to something that is much more fragmented and much more centered in the computer. Then when I looked at social services, and particularly in Ontario, where there's been a very high degree of automation and computerization under the Harris Conservative government, what I found there was how people have shifted their attention and they are beginning to look to the computer screen for their cues on what's real. And there's two things driving that. And this you can extrapolate to a number of areas. One is accountability. With globalization, with contracting out, with more and more scrutiny of scarce public dollars, there's been a new emphasis on accountability everywhere in our society. The trouble is, so much of that accountability has been defined in terms of what can be measured, and particularly measured in numbers. So accountability for a teacher is getting the grade point average right. In a college, placing your students into jobs. In hospitals, shorten the waiting time, increase the speed and efficiency of turning over hospital beds. No wonder people start to pay attention more to the stuff on the screen. If that's what counts as the measure of accountability, what choice do you have? Particularly when you have no time. And that's the kicker. Because if people had the discretionary time, they could still sort of say, hey, do the data really add up? And they could do their own sort of reality checks. Yes, sort of, yes, we'll make sure that we get the grade point average. But meanwhile, our real job as teachers, for instance, is engaging with the students so that they feel that they are important, that they matter, and what they have to say matters. And then you can draw them into a learning process where they actually begin to feel confident that they can learn something and they can master something because they've got the teacher who's paying that really close attention and encouraging them and all that sort of thing. If there is no time for doing anything except make that delivery window, produce according to the deliverables, it's that much easier for people to capitulate and start to act as though what does count, what is real, is the stuff on the screen. Processing the information, getting the report in on time, the marks, the student marks logged and registered and all that kind of thing. More and more people keeping their eyes on the screen and losing touch with what the data actually relate to and losing touch with what matters out there and then beginning to neglect what really matters, beginning to actually abandon the real. And so I paid attention to the death of a underweight baby born in Toronto called baby Jordan Heikamp, because the coroner's jury who looked into his death by starvation, this baby died of starvation while officially under the care of the social welfare state in a government-approved shelter, with a social worker looking assigned to the mother and the baby. The coroner's jury confronted this paradox that when they looked at the data for accountability, people couldn't be faulted. They'd processed the information, they had tracked the case, they had, you know, calls had been made, calls had been returned, and each one noted in various logs. All these fragments added up to accountable performance. Meanwhile, nobody was paying attention to a baby. And when a baby starves to death, it's pretty noticeable. Extremely wrinkled skin, very sunken eyes. At the beginning, the social worker was charged with criminal negligence, and at the end, the jury absolutely exonerated her. Even though the death was ruled a homicide, therefore there was culpability, nobody was to blame. But to my mind, it was the system that is to blame, where you engineer a closed system that leaves the capacity for reengaging with humanity, that engineers the time required, the pace required, engineers it out of the picture. That then is culpable. Now, once I got to this point in my kind of roaming around, because this book really was a kind of a journey, a very personal journey involving some pretty personal conversations with people. Like, I came to Vancouver and stumbled into a conversation with David Suzuki on this very theme of abandoning the real, where we were talking about the nature of things, and he was saying, you know, well, we don't really offer nature on TV, it's nature hopped up on steroids. and I said, well, maybe they should rename the program The Denature of Things. But then he went on and he said, and then what happens is people watch the programs and then they want to go out to the destination, the desirable destination, and they want to see this nature. They want to see the jolts per minute, the whale instantly, the jaguar instantly. They said they want nature with all the boring bits edited out. And he said, of course, nature is just time itself, where you just sit there and let it be and let it move you. But he said, that's gone. Everybody, you know, they want their bang for their buck. And the end result, he said, is that people are, what he said, loving nature to death, which I thought was putting it very, very nicely. what we are doing is we are turning nature into a desert by trampling on it, by over demands and treating nature as a commodity, just to be exploited, just to be used, just to be consumed instantly and on to the next thing. Still, I felt if we're still able to engage with each other, then we can keep our feet on the ground of what's real. We can renew our reverence for life itself amongst each other and in nature. So when somebody says, you know, kind of get with the program, buy this, see this, etc., we can say, hey, get real. Because we still have a sense of what's real and we can still check it out with each other. So the next stage of my journey was, hey, I wanted to see whether this was in fact true. And what I found was very disquieting. I looked first at kids and I discovered all this stuff on ADD. And at the heart of it, one of the problems is that we're dealing with so many harried parents, overworked parents. They bring the multitasking home. I already alluded to this guy who's a workaholic. And that's sort of an extreme case. But so many people, they're interrupted by work demands at home, or they decide they're doing job-related learning at home. This is 5 hours a week on average now. And so instead of their being able to give their infants and toddlers their complete focused attention and becoming attuned to their infants, they aren't able to do so. And yet that is absolutely vital. It's as infants feel that their rhythms and their needs are responded to, that they begin to respond themselves. And this is the foundation of social engagement. As parents become attuned to their babies and begin to enter into the rhythms of communication, first of all, it's all nonverbal, and then it's that baby talk stuff and the games, the peekaboo games and all that kind of thing. I found an incredible, exciting, rich literature on this and how vital it is. It's like the second stage of delivery, you know, the delivery out of the body. But the second stage is delivery into the world as a social participant, able to listen to others, able to be attuned to others. It starts in the home, and it requires a non-stressed, non-distracting environment. This is really got to come back. Right now, it's gone. There's too many distractions. The home that used to be, hopefully, at least potentially a slow zone and a little refuge away from the hurly-burly, is now just part of the zone of flows and distractions. So that was one of the things that I found. If kids do get that attuned attention, they grow up and they go to school ready. They also grow up with a much better capacity for empathy and conscience. That was the other thing I found in my research. Without this, the handicaps are so severe. They're more likely to, well, the other thing is, if the parents aren't there to be paying attention to them, often these kids are the ones that are more readily early plunked in front of TVs, and then when they're old enough, given computer games and so on and so forth. So their sense of time, instead of developing a sense of time that is a rhythmic continuity from past through present into the future, and the capacity to be patient, to let time unfold, let someone finish their sentence, or et cetera, their sense of time is the present moment. Click, 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 snap, 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 click, click, the channel changer or whatever the case might be. And then they grow up more likely to have ADD, attention deficit disorder. And then there's a whole bunch of other things. Problem youth gambling, which is becoming a big issue right now. A very strong correlation between ADD kids and kids with a compulsive gambling problem. Of course, it's great for the economy because they're compulsive buyers, and then they'll be compulsive workers, too. But is that what we want by way of raising our children? I wonder. Then I looked at post-secondary education, and to my mind, one of the very important things that happens there is, no matter what the discipline, even not just arts and science, but engineering, etc., and the sciences as well. Is the important thing is that students learn to think critically and begin to be drawn into society's conversations. These are often profession specific, but that's where the larger issues of society come down and manifest themselves and are articulated in everyday life. What I found, I teamed up with a wonderful social science sociologist at York University to do an academic time survey. And not only are academics just chronically overextended, but they've got all kinds of new demands to raise money for research in this context of underfunding, new reporting requirements, and the upshot is that on the one hand, they're feeling pretty good about the fact that more people know about their work with the fact that you can disseminate online. They're in touch with people all around the world. But on the other hand, they're not in touch with colleagues on the campus, and they're less in touch with their students. They're not reading as broadly nor as deeply and reflectively as they would like to or as they used to. That was overwhelming in terms of the people who said no to that one. Instead, they're skimming. So their whole kind of intellectual existence is thinning out and becoming actually very superficial. And the trouble is, this is having very dire consequences. One said, I can't slow down enough to think. That was talking generally about creative process. Another said, in meetings, I'm falling more and more silent because I'm not having that opportunity to chit-chat with my colleagues. We used to always just be in the hall or dropping in each other's office or just, you know, wherever. And did you read this? Did you see this? And it's sort of like a reality check plus, as this one person said, the people you trust, you're willing to be vulnerable to, and they'll push you. Well, that's okay. You said the obvious cliche, but what about this? And so you're tested constantly by your colleagues in this kind of little mini dialogue on campus to identify contradictions, basically to think critically. This woman said, I'm losing that opportunity, so I'm less confident of what I have to say, so I'm not speaking so much. So what are they modeling to their students if they're not modeling critical thinking and engaged conversation? What they're modeling is cut and paste. Basically, instead of dialogue, PowerPoint. And I don't know what your feelings are about PowerPoint, but I've got a bit of a thing about PowerPoint. I go to conferences and people always have these laptops and their PowerPoint, and I could just feel the energy going out of the room. Because it's all points. And actually, it's all data. You know, all the stuff people came for, which is the fecund interpretation, the passionate projection of a vision or a point of view, that just doesn't compute in a PowerPoint presentation. So anyway, that's unfortunately what we're getting. And so instead of young people learning to find their own voice and to be encouraged by mentoring-type professors, that what they have to say and think actually matters, they're just focusing on the deliverables, the course requirements, pass, get on with it, get a job if you can. So instead of them learning to be experts within a larger frame of being citizens, more and more we're getting universities turning out just the technocratic experts. Then I sort of said, okay, I'm going to put the pieces together. The shift in what we pay attention to is real, and where we take our cues from in terms of what's real and relevant, combining with a shift in how we engage with each other in the world. A shift from face-to-face, engaged dialogue over time, where trust develops and real getting to know you, to something much more superficial, much more short-term, much more fragmented, and much more based on this the flow of data on the screen. And I worried that this is a setup for a societal disconnect and even becoming a dysfunctional society. Now, I have been described, accused, whatever, depending if it's a friend or or someone not necessarily a friend, being, oh, Heather, you're such a Cassandra, you're such a Jeremiah, you know, doom and gloom. And it's true that I have a certain tendency that way. I'm willing to admit it. But I will say in my own defense that I have always gone on the feminist principle, the personal is political. And one of the ways that I've interpreted that is that the larger trends that are sort of you can identify intellectually in ideas terms, in graphic, potentially Cassandra kind of terms, are, if they really are something to pay to worry about, you'll find them in quotidian, everyday life. And so when I had the gut sense that I needed to take my journey to Walkerton, Ontario, at the time they were wrapping up the inquiry into the tragedy that occurred in May 2000, when after a long period of heavy, heavy rain, some toxic water got into, E. coli contaminated water got into the drinking water of the town. Half the townspeople, one out of every two people, in other words, was sick, all with the same symptoms. The upshot was 7 people died. Hundreds have been left with permanent kidney and bowel illnesses. Why, I thought, why didn't people do something? Take action. When the technocratic experts goofed up, why couldn't they sort of fill in the gap? Why couldn't they come forward and pool their shared knowledge and do something? I went and I talked to people, and one of the phrases I can remember is some woman saying, well, we all knew what was going on, but it was all just chit-chat. And it wasn't real. We didn't really believe that it was something we should do anything about. But there was one exception, and that was also what galvanized my attention and brought me to Walkerton. In the Bruce Lee Senior's Residence, the clinical nurse, not the person in charge of the thing, not even the head nurse, the clinical nurse, 27-year-old Lisa Stroder, took it upon herself at 4:30 in the afternoon on Friday leading into this long weekend, which is when the tragedy really set in, and that's when people got sick to the point that they were dying. She took it upon herself to switch the entire residence from their local town water to boiled water, bottled water. So one of the things I wanted to do is find out why. And so I sat her down in an interview, and we went through it all and so on and so forth. And one of the big things is that her reality was not data on the screen. It was partly informed, obviously, by data on the screen, but it was very much the people in front of her. And she had the discretionary time that she could back off. She credited that. She said, if I hadn't had time to go into my office and just sit there and kind of let it all scroll through, you know, the kids at the school were sick, being sent home sick, same symptoms as the people here, people all over the place, staff with family members, what's going on? It's something that is common to the whole town. It can't be just food. And then she sat there, and right across from her was the dining room, the open doors of the dining room, and they were about to bring the seniors in for the first sitting at 4:30. And she could see those jugs of water on every table. And it was very real to her that she was accountable for the health of those people who were about to come in and drink that water. And she couldn't answer for the danger that she thought they might be in under if they drank that water. So at 4:30, she got up, she went into the kitchen. She had no authority to tell the people, get that water off the table, let's use bottled water. She simply said, we should do this, we must do this. And the thing is, everybody immediately did it, because they too knew. She was able to name what in fact was real. And the other lovely thing was that staff stayed late just to boil water so that they could wash everything, make sure everything was absolutely scrupulously clean. It was common sense in the original sense of the word that Thomas Paine meant when he wrote that magnificent, very famous essay on common sense, when he named that the people of America in the 13 colonies, the sentiment of grievance and determination to be on their own had reached the point where he named the reality, it's time to declare independence, folks. And so they did. Because not only did he name it, but he, what was the phrase they used? He articulated in language that made the reality of this make sense to people. And that's why, that's where the meaning of the word common sense, that's what he meant there. John Ralston Saul, in his book Equilibrium, on Equilibrium, said, if we organize society so we can't use our common sense, we become dysfunctional. And I think that's true, and I agree with him. It's a setup for either hysteria or totalitarianism. Now, on the hysteria side, there's the democratic deficit, there's the decline of civil society and civic dialogue, and I touched on that a little bit there. We're getting kind of another sort of object lesson in that, to a certain extent, with the Gomery Inquiry. Because on the one hand, yes, it's talking about the rot in the Liberal Party, but the other thing, tacitly, is talking about the rot in the democratic process, surely. That political persuasion can come down to, so much come down to, ad agency, branding, and spin doctoring. I mean, since when did ad agencies loom so large in political persuasion? They do so when there's a vacuum that is the lack and absence of genuinely engaged democratic dialogue. Totalitarianism can easily move in to that kind of vacuum. And I choose my word very, very carefully when I say totalitarianism, having read Hannah Arendt's excellent, excellent, The Origins of Totalitarianism. In fact, I think I've read everything by Hannah Arendt. I have an enormous respect for not only her intellect, but the passionate honesty with which she pursued a few fundamental questions that came to her when she was in Berlin, a young woman, freshly university educated, and watched the Nuremberg laws being brought into place, and watched as supposedly intelligent, well-educated people were going along with them because they thought they were sort of reasonable. And one of the things that she argued is that she said that totalitarianism can succeed when common sense has lost its validity. And where the traditions of consensus building and civic dialogue have broken down. Then abstractions, stock phrases, slogans, and other elements of officialese can fill the gap, she said. Now all we need to do today is substitute the branded words, the key words, like what does Bush say all the time? Secure, free, and so on and so forth. The events since September the 11th, I think, have really raised the stakes on this whole question, to my mind. And I ended the book with a short epilogue in which I dared to bring together the themes of my book and what I'd learned into that context. And I said that what I was seeing there was that both Bush and Osama bin Laden were kind of avatar figures of a virtual reality, a simulated reality. Just the mix and match, keywords, totally abstracted, no sense of context, no sense of historical continuity, all just words used, marshaled for the management of public perception and the enticement and eliciting of affect and feeling. Feeling of fear, people can be very, very easily led if they are afraid, and to a certain extent a feeling of pride and jingoistic patriotism. So I kind of talked a little bit about this on both sides, this kind of symbol level of reality, but then I also found myself looking into and discovering the another kind of reality that was going on even that September the 11th. And this was, it started in examples like the incredible outpouring of the firefighters' help and the mutual assistance that people gave each other in the stairwells. As a result, and this might come as a surprise to some of you, fully 99% of the people who were on the floors below where the planes went in got out of that building alive that morning before the buildings collapsed. And we all know those buildings collapsed fast. 99% survival rate. I call it a dialogue of survival. And it wasn't the only part of it. There were thousands of people in Ottawa lined up to give blood that day. And I'm sure there were thousands in Toronto, all over the place. People came out in expressions of compassion, condolence. There was hardly any expression of anger. This was a tragic crime that had been committed. It wasn't a war until Bush named it that. Meanwhile, the dialogue is continued, interfaith dialogues, and more people saying, we need to address the root causes of the problems in our world. Inequality, injustice, intolerance. I ended the book on a somewhat equivocal note. Quote, I want to see these efforts as a hopeful awakening, a groundswell of recommitment to the values, and more to the point, the time and social habits on which peace in our lives and peace in our world depend. But to democratize this new world order and direct it to serve peace and equilibrium requires more than a few well-intentioned gestures. More and more of us must break out of our isolated individualism and distracted busyness and join the dialogue that is society. September the 11th and what followed have indeed raised the stakes. Being elsewhere, being otherwise engaged, is no longer an option. We need to talk.
I don't know good horse. We trot in this dark heat, and robbing the rich is for worse or for best. They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black vest. I treat horses good.
That's it for this week. I hope you found it a thought-provoking show. I certainly did, as I was working on the show's website at unwelcomeguests.net. I have used a wiki, which means the site is editable. Every episode has its own page. This episode's is unwelcomeguests.net/514. And there's a category index and a list of speakers. The show has a mailing list at www.altruists.org/unwelcome for anyone interested in giving feedback on the show, suggesting ideas, otherwise making a contribution to future episodes. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.